Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you for tearing yourself away from the delicious fillet steak that we had for dinner and turning up. I'd like to start by thanking Bridget and Clint and Ron for putting on this wonderful meeting and for allowing me to take part. It's my first NRAM workshop, and I very much hope it won't be the last. I was particularly... the questions! I liked the idea that they had of seizing on a topic that I think we're all concerned with and interested in one way or another, heterogeneity and variability in macromolecular specimens and the strategies for how to deal with it. And basically, they've asked almost all of the speakers to come at this issue from their respective angles. Now, that's the good news. The bad news for me is that you've already had 8 presentations on this topic, and there's not much left for me to say. Other things than, like, I violently disagree with what Grant said this morning, or I fully agree with what Fred said, or I 72% agree with Richard on such and such a point. But what I'll do is I'll try to take a sort of similar approach to the other speakers in the sense of in the sense of doing some case histories, and then what I hope will be the second half of the talk, I'll zip through 4 case histories pretty quickly, which have deal with heterogeneity in images and heterogeneity in specimens in various ways, and then I'll try and tell a more or less coherent biological story of recent work from our lab. So, machines with moving parts, see how they run. For those who weren't brought up in a British nursery, see how they run is actually a punchline from a child's poem called Three Blind Mice. But visualization and structure function, of course, is important. So, you've seen variations of this thought in, I think, almost every speaker's presentation. One can divide the factors that cause variability in electron micrographs really into 3 groups. There's the direction that your projection is coming from, there's intrinsic variability of the complexes, and of course there's noise, which is random but different from image to image. And in category 2, intrinsic variability can come from 3 factors. There can be contaminants, there can be breakdown products, there can be aggregates, and there can even be the molecules that you're potentially interested in. And the good guys can also exhibit, in some cases, multiple discrete conformations, for instance, the state of nucleotide binding or whatever the fact would be. And third, and I think the most difficult one, is continuous variability. You can have flexible parts, you can have local mobility, and you can have global breathing. And these are sort of problems that don't really enter into the analyses undertaken by protein crystallographers, but we're looking at molecules in solution, talking about single particle analysis, and we have somehow to come to terms with it. And Stan Burgess, I think, gave a particularly nice presentation on his work and his group's work on dynein and how they've addressed the problem. So this is my agenda. As I told you, there are going to be 4 vignettes on these topics. There's what I call, and I think nobody else calls, multiple particle analysis. We've in our field, we've sort of taken time for nomenclature to sink in. And I think it was a long time until single particle analysis really became accepted. I think it's an atrocious term because it's not analysis of single particles, it's of tens of thousands or nowadays hundreds of thousands of particles. But if we're going to call that single particle analysis because we've got a single 3-dimensional current model unifying all these data, if we allow for the possibility of more than one, we should call it multiple particle analysis, and please do. I think it's a very persuasive argument. Now, one of the nice things about multiple particle analysis, if you sort of control the time development of your system, you can visualize multiple conformations, and under favorable circumstances, you can order them into a time series and do what we refer to in-house as four-dimensional cryo-electron microscopy, where time resolution. So I'm going to talk about a project that was completed actually a few years ago, but I feel you haven't heard enough about it, so we're going to start off with that one. Something very recent that we do is sort of contradiction in terms, what we call thermo-cryo-electron microscopy, and what can that possibly be? You'll hear in a few minutes. And resolution, of course, is always a good topic for getting people worked up. And I won't let the opportunity pass by. The point that I'm going to pick up on this evening is something that Andy Hunger introduced into the presentation, I think, in the opening night during Tom Maltz's presentation. He said resolution isn't homogeneous. You get local bits of your structure where you have low resolution and the rest may be a bit higher. And a member of our group has sort of addressed that problem quantitatively, and I'll briefly show you his very recently derived resolution criterion that allows for local variations in resolution. Now, I'd like to have a sort of anecdote about the smallest feature that we have ever been able to visualize, which is a nonapeptide of less than a kilodalton. And, of course, that's pretty small beer compared to the side chains and individual amino acids that Hong Zhu and others of the really high-resolution crowd are doing. But I'd just like to show that as an example, because it contrasts with the largest feature that we have not been able to see, which is 100 times bigger. We have a 10 angstrom, very, I think, respectable map in which a 90 kilodalton component is completely invisible. And finally, the biological story. So, the first project is the assembly part, is a small piece of the herpes simplex virus assembly pathway, which is a long-standing collaboration between our group, and in particular Jay Brown and Bill Newcomb in Charlottesville. And the people who have contributed to the part of the study that I'm going to show about have been these: Nai Chen Cheng, our top gun cryo-electron microscopist, Bernard and Giovanni and Venice are all computer specialists, and Bernard and Giovanni have had particularly to do with this project. So, like other related viruses, herpes simplex virus initially assembles a precursor particle of procapsid, no DNA inside it. In the normal course of events, this procapsid serves as a receptacle into which DNA is packaged. And this process induces major conformational changes. The procapsid that you can see here at about 20-odd angstroms resolution is almost perfectly spherical. Its hexamers are very elongated and distorted from local six-fold symmetry, and it's rather porous. You can see the night sky peering through these chinks in the lattice. After maturation, it becomes polyhedral. The hexamers become very regular, and the floor fills in. This particle is very robust. This one is very feeble. If you take freshly isolated procapsids and leave them in the ice bucket 4 degrees in PBS, half an hour later, you don't have any more procapsids. They just fall apart under these relatively benign conditions. But these guys are very tough. So we're interested in mapping. We get an image of the precursor. We get an image of the mature capsid. And we're interested in what happens in between. Now, getting back to the lab bench, if instead of leaving your freshly isolated procapsids on ice, you leave them at room temperature and you wait, over a course of several days, this maturation process will take place spontaneously without the intervention of DNA packaging. So this is really a nice time course for you to sample, take cryo-EM samples. And Bernard Hyman is the person who undertook analyzing the data. Right, so this is what a field of freshly isolated procapsids looks like. 2 days later, they look like this. And of course, if you look carefully from point to point, you say, well, herpes is a big capsid. It has a diameter of 1,250 angstroms, so there's plenty to see. But they all look a bit different. And of course, the factors are there is maturation taking place, but they all represent different views. So we have to try and separate them. So this was the classification strategy that Bernard followed. He had data at 4 time points. He had a starting model, he had a finishing model, and he just made linear combinations in between. So you ask of each image at each time point which orientation it likes and which of these maps it most resembles in terms of a sort of primitive similarity metric. That's what we call them, isn't it, Steve? Correlation coefficient. And you assign data to each pot, you calculate a next generation of reconstructions, and you recycle. And, okay, so how reliable can we be in discriminating differences in viewing geometry from differences in maturational state? Here are just two examples, okay? So here's a particle that is being viewed fairly close to a twofold symmetry axis. And here for maps 1, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 17 are the corresponding selected views. And you can see maps 1 and 7 actually get it wrong. Maps 8 to 17 get the viewing geometry correct. And there are only slight improvements in the correlation coefficient in the winner, which in this case was map 11. And you see a similar thing going on. If your map is far enough away from the actual one, you'll get the wrong view. But all of these guys are pretty similar, and this one in this case was the winner. So at the end of the analysis, after 5 cycles of iteration, this is how the data partition. At 0 time point, you can see that they were not all entirely virginal procapsids. Only about 40% of them were, but some of them were already significantly advanced along the maturation pathway, and they were advanced because it took Bill several hours to complete the isolation, and of course the capsids had actually been produced at several different times over a period of about 12 hours during the infection. Now the big change takes place between 24 and 48 when it goes from mainly early precursors to late precursors, and then at 96 they're not all completely mature, but the majority are sort of heading in that direction. So what Bernard could do is that he put these together in a movie, and movies actually are very complex. I'm just going to show it for a few seconds to give you a flavor of what the data look like, but you can see this morphing process, the process is swelling across the capsid. Now we're now going to look at the inner surface. Here are hexamers, and they are changing, eventually developing this complex continuity of density along the inner surface. And then finally, the hexon, this elongated hexon that is near the penton, you can see it gradually changing shape as the bottom fills in. So it really took quite a lot of time to appreciate what's all going on here. And this is essentially the bottom line. Here's the outer surface, precursor, mature, inner surface, mature, precursor, mature. This is really quite a remarkable picture because you can see that neighboring hexamers don't actually touch each other. They're coordinated only through the interactions they make with these green proteins here, which are heterotrimers. But in maturation, they rotate and establish contacts to give this continuity of density. And you could see these sort of banana-shaped molecules reestablishing their interactions by rigid body rotations. And I want you in particular to note the low-resolution banana shape of this molecule, because you're going to see something like it very shortly in an entirely different and unexpected context and at much higher resolution. So I'm going to try and answer some of the questions posed by Bridget and her collaborators on the way along. So what were the issues in doing multiple particle analysis to achieve time-resolved cryo-EM? First of all, you have to make a decision about the number of states and the number of models, and I don't think there are any absolutely rigorous ways of doing that, but my recommendation would be to conservative. Where do you get starting models? A very good question. You need a good signal-to-noise ratio in the primary data in order to reliably discriminate between different viewing geometries and different conformational states. And this is how Bernard did it. And you need a lot of data. He actually analyzed something in excess of 5,000 particles. Now, in 2002, that was a lot of data. In 2009, it's an almost embarrassingly small amount of data. So I suppose the bottom line is we should return to the same project with 50 or 100,000 particles and push the resolution a bit further. But that's the way the field goes. And finally, if you like, you can do kinetic modeling for the sort of flow of particles through the succession of states. Now, thermocryo-electron microscopy. Let me, This again was a multi-group collaboration and a long-standing one. This set of people refer to themselves as the Hong Kong 97 Cabal. And the center of gravity is in Pittsburgh, where Bob Duda and Roger Hendricks have their group. And James Conway, who's done all the cryo reconstructions, is now on the faculty in this department. I have colleagues at NIH who have contributed, and then there's the Wild West Coast chapter led by Jack Johnson. And I'm sure in this building you know all about what they've been able to do. So here is a cryo-EM representation of the pathway in reconstructions that are about 10 angstroms, in some cases a bit better. This particle, it's a bacteriophage that infects E. coli, not Hong Kong, not herpes simplex virus, which infects Homo sapiens, but it is a lot in common. It first produces a procapsid, which in this case is called Prohead 1, and then there's a proteolytic cleavage event that converts Prohead 1 to Prohead 2, and if you look at the inner surface, you can see that pieces of protein are coded yellow here that are removed by the action of the phage protease. Prohead 2 is a metastable particle. It's poised to embark on these sort of dramatic conformational changes in a process that is called expansion. And there are essentially three staging processes. There's this expansion intermediate 1 or 2. There's this particle, which we tend not to call expansion intermediate 3 or 4, but we call it the balloon nowadays. And then there's the finally mature head, which is almost twice the internal volume of the original particle. During, as expansion takes place, a remarkable biochemical reaction takes place between neighboring subunits. They spontaneously form covalent crosslinks without the intervention of an enzyme, and that really stabilizes the particle. And the formation of the crosslinks, the first ones of which appear at this stage, helps to propagate and push the maturation pathway along. Now, Jack Johnson and originally Bill Wyckoff, but later other members of his group, made a real breakthrough in 2001, I think it was, when they published the first crystal structure of the final mature capsid and produced this depiction of the fold, and you can see it forms these interlocked rings, and these points here are where the covalent crosslinks are formed. And they've gone on to sort of do crystallography in other states, but in every state we've been able to essentially use this as a rigid body with sort of somewhat movable elements to generate pseudo-atomic models. But there was a little bit of a problem in this at an energetic level. What we thought was going on, is that if you look just at the structural changes in the absence of the covalent cross-linking, you say, well, this guy is going to be tough, and this guy is going to be less tough. It's going to be a toughening process for the particle. And VJ Reddy measured for us the amount of buried surface area in this state and this state, and it was approximately doubled. But it turned out that this particle, if you don't have cross-linking, is in fact less tough than this one. And we were able to show this by a technique called differential scanning calorimetry. We call the particle Hong Kong 91 if it can become to complete structural maturation but without forming cross-links. And you can see that it melts in a calorimetry tricky experiment. You sort of scan up, and then you can measure the phase transitions that affect the capsid, and eventually there's thermal denaturation. And thermal denaturation for head 1, the endpoint of the non-cross-linking pathway, is actually at a lower temperature than the precursor prohead 2. What you can also do with this sort of data is that you can measure these temperatures and you can measure the areas under the curves. And if you make a few assumptions, I would claim that they're reasonable, in fact, inspired assumptions, you can come up with estimates for the Gibbs free energy of the respective states. And it turns out this maturation pathway is what we call a free energy cascade. The original state capsomers, hexamers, and pentamers are building blocks. When they actually fall down by about 1.5 kilocalories per mole when they go to this state, and then about another 3 kilocalories per mole to this state, we haven't actually been able to measure these particles separately, calorimetry, but then there's a huge fall finally into the head 2 state. Okay, so that's what we can get out of the denaturation endotherms. What about the other events that we see in the thermograms? And these are the thermograms for the capsomers down here, prohead 1 when they're assembled into a particle, and prohead 2 when the N-terminal domain has been removed by proteolysis. This is a rather interesting little event that takes place at 53 degrees. It is, in fact, reversible, unlike the denaturations. Once they're gone for good. But you can scan up through this temperature, you can back down again, and record it as many times as you like. If you go to this point, you're dead. So it'd be interesting to know what structural change this phase transition represents. And so, to look at this by cryo, our strategy was to incubate them at an elevated temperature beyond the transition, and then try and capture it by very rapidly freezing. So we had to make this sort of homemade environmental chamber, and you can see Naichen Cheng's hand poised with his grid over the cryogen ready to go. And this is kept at high humidity and whichever temperature you like. You can actually do temperatures like this if you happen to have a Vitrobot and you don't want to go any higher than 60 degrees. But we did want to go beyond that, so we made our own. And here is a field of the particles of prohead 1 that was heated at 60 degrees, which is higher than 53 degrees. And you can do a quick visual classification, I'm sure, and convince yourself that they're now mainly small particles. They're also bigger particles. So you can do a classification, and you can do reconstructions. And you find that the small particles after heating at 60 degrees are exactly the same as the starting material. You have this shell. And the transitions I'm going to tell you about are perhaps best viewed in these density sections. So you have these highly convoluted surfaces, blister-like capsomers, and you have this more or less ill-defined density on the inner surface. So what happens in the large particles at 60 degrees? Well, you can see that the pentamer, which is this site, just moves outward by about 25 angstroms. But the hexamer next to it changes very radically. And it changes to resemble a hexamer that we have seen elsewhere. It's the EI12. So to summarize what's going on here is that the 53-degree event of prohead 1, this particle here, is a reversible phase transition. After this transition, the pentamers remain in the initial state, but the hexamers leapfrog over this state to this state. And the delta domains of the hexamers, but not the pentamers, become disordered in this transition. Let me just go back and show you that. So here, you can still see the delta domains here, but they're completely gone here. Okay, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Can we back up? Yeah, okay. So next point, resolution isn't homogeneous in density maps. These are threefold views through prohead 1 and prohead 2. And you can see a lot of very nice, convoluted, sharply defined density. These maps are about 9 angstroms, I think. But there are other parts of density, the inner surface and the outer surface, that are blurred. Can we quantitate that? Well, I can't, but Giovanni Cardoni in our group can. He worked out an algorithm to calculate local resolution. So you have a look, you can in fact generate a resolution map for your particle. And in this case, he has represented it by color. So if it's your 16 angstroms, this is another kind of herpes simplex virus capsid, as the inner parts of the shell are, you're about 16 angstroms, but the outer parts are at about 20 angstroms, and if you have these stringy molecules, about 120 angstroms along, that are found at sites around the penton but not elsewhere, the resolution drops to 25 angstroms. And the reason for that, I can tell you, is mainly because of partial occupancy. These sites are only occupied about 50% of the time on average, but the other ones are at 100%. David?
So what was his criterion, the strength of the density?
No, he makes lots of different three-dimensional reconstructions, and then compares the density locally using a technique called the short space Fourier transform. He's writing a paper, and we'll try to publish it very soon. So here's another example of the short space resolution map. This is a hepatitis B virus capsid, which is the red thing, and that's at about 8 angstroms resolution, and there are antibodies bound to it, but their resolution, particularly the outer part, is almost twice as bad. And the reason for that, in this case, it's to some extent partial occupancy, but it's also that the Fabs appear to rock about their point of contact. And probably when Fab-labeled capsids come into a very thin film of buffer, there are surface tension effects and other things going on to which they respond, which cause them to rock around their point of contact so that they are less well-defined in the final density map. Okay, so the smallest molecular feature we have been able to see, we saw an association with this. This is James Conway's 1997 reconstruction of hepatitis B virus at about 9 angstroms resolution. In fact, if we went back and recalculated this map, I'm sure it's better than 9 angstroms resolution, because it was done at a time when we calculated resolution throughout the box, not just in the thin shell where there is protein. But still, that's what it was. Now, a couple of years later, the group in Cambridge in England, Andrew Leslie et al. Solved the crystal structure, and they confirmed all the information about the alpha helices and added a great deal of very detailed information. But one thing that they couldn't tell was where the last 7 residues of CP149 are. Here is the C-terminus. This is a dimer. There's a green subunit and a yellow subunit. This is residue 142. So the question arises, is the missing peptide? So we had access to constructs in which the 9 residues were missing and the 9 residues were present. This is capsid protein with 140 residues. This is with 149. And here are the sum of the data. And you can actually see that removing those 9 invisible in the crystal structure residues actually changes something. HBV capsids come in 2 sizes. There's T equals 3, the smaller ones, and T equals 4, the larger ones. With this construct, it's a majority of small capsids. With this construct, it's a majority of large capsids. So James Conway did the reconstructions from Nai-Chin Cheng's data. We calculated a difference map, and here is the missing density. You can see it is on the inner surface, underlying in rings of 5 and 6, the capsomers. And just to carry this a little bit further, we did a database search, and this sequence in the C-terminal peptide is almost totally identical to one on a surface, extended surface structure of cellulose dehydrogenase. And that extended peptide, of course, fits very nicely into the elongated densities that we see. So why does this matter? Well, we could visualize this 9-residue peptide, and we were sort of quite pleased about that, but functionally it's quite important. If you reduce the length of CP140 any further, the protein loses the ability to assemble into capsids. And this peptide that we could see is actually more than just a flexible linker, because if you delete it and make this construct, when the C-terminal part of the protein, which binds the RNA in the assembly reaction and which was removed for the purposes of these experiments, if you move it up right to be next to this, again, the protein loses the ability to assemble into capsids. So that's the conclusions. So coming now to the main feature, if you like, we're going to tell you a brief story about a machine that really has a very vexing number of moving parts. Yet again, this is a long-running collaboration between my group and Mike Morizzi and his colleagues in the Laboratory of Cell Biology in the National Cancer Institute, of whom the latest incumbent working with us is an Italian fellow called Gianmarco De Donatis. Previous work on this system have been done by Martin Kessel, David Belknap, Fabien Buron, with very strong contribution from Joaquin Ortega, who is here at the meeting. And the work that I'm going to tell you about in the rest of my talk has been done by Gregory Affantin and Takashi Ishikawa. So, in cells, there is constantly proteolysis going on. And it's going on for two main purposes. One, if part of the proteome gets into trouble, becomes denatured, gets out of the way, it has to be essentially eliminated and its amino acids recycled. The other thing is that you may want to eliminate regulatory proteins to adjust the pattern of gene expression. And so both of these activities require intracellular proteolysis, but that's an activity that has to be regulated very carefully, because you can't have proteases diffusing around, causing havoc by chewing up proteins that they shouldn't be dealing with. So how does nature address this problem? Well, it does it by compartmentalization. What it does is make a little cage, this light blue cage here, with small holes that folded proteins can't get in, and the active sites of the protease are displayed in this inner surface. So the only way anything is going to get chewed up by a protease of this kind is if some other molecule, be it a chaperone, what we call a chaperone ATPase, recognizes it, unfolds it, translocates it into the cell, where processive degradation into small peptides will take place. Now, that is the basic principle, and there are many variations on this theme. You can have a digestion chamber with ATPases at both ends, or you can have a regulatory factor at one end and an ATPase here, or you can bind regulatory factors to the ATPase itself. You could put different ATPases at different ends of the barrel, or you could employ a two-tiered peptidase, as is done in the 20S proteasome, which is the daddy of them all for enzymes of this class, or you can have a two-tiered ATPase, as in the case of the system that I'm going to be telling you about, which is the CLIP-A ATPase of E. coli. So E. coli has four members of this family. They're called A, B, Y, and X, and they are all AAA-plus proteins. Now, you've heard in several previous talks at the meeting other members of this family, NSF, P97, and of course, the dynein that Stan talked about, which actually has got 6 or 7 tandem copies. In CLIP-A, there are 2 copies of the AAA module, and there is an N-terminal domain that's about 60% as big as either of them. And these are just other members of the family. So now, this is an fairly early negative stain picture. And you can readily see why we used to refer to them in the lab as the big macrosome, because here are the various strata of a big mac. And in negative state, everything is great. The particles lie down on their sides, and you can see that there are generally six striations. But some of them have more than six striations. For instance, okay, here's two central striations, two more here, but it looks like there's another one here. And there's something else at this end, but others of them don't. And our thinking, although it's maybe too sort of grandiose a term to call it thinking, our notions about what these terminal striations might be have evolved over the 15 years we've been working on the project.